This is C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal. This week, the road to the White House comes to an end.
I, William Jefferson Clinton, do solemnly swear.
I, William Jefferson Clinton, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Thus, you'll hear from more of President Clinton's cabinet nominees and some of the sounds of Wednesday's inaugural celebration. It's all ahead in the next hour on C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal.
Galt, California is next. Good morning.
Good morning.
While many of President Clinton's cabinet nominations were approved by the full Senate Wednesday and Thursday, some nominees were still sitting in front of the committees responsible for their approval. One of those was Attorney General nominee Zoe Baird, who has been involved in some controversy the past few days. Thursday morning, one of C-SPAN's call-in programs focused on the nomination of Ms. Baird. Here are the thoughts of some of our viewers.
Cumberland, Rhode Island is next. Good morning.
No matter what her qualifications are, I don't think they're that great. I think she should do him a favor and just back off, because the fact of the matter is, what her and her husband did, they broke the law. They violated federal tax laws and probably numerous other laws. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. But they would be doing him a favor if they just backed off, because that's giving the impression that, you know, as long as you got the connections, you can do what you want to do. And for them to say they didn't know what was going on, they're both supposed to be good lawyers. And they hired a lawyer, and they said he advised them to do it. I mean, you know, come on. The American people are a lot smarter than they used to be, as evident by how many people were interested in the election.
Northridge, California.
I guess I wonder why is it that all of this fuss is made about the women and the black attorneys, and to what extent was her husband culpable? I have a feeling that she was very, very, very busy, and she was relying on her professor husband to do a lot of this. And I mean, after all, professors have a huge amount of discretionary time and corporate attorneys don't. So, you know, I really think she's getting it because she's a woman. Just the special circumstances of women.
Hartford, Connecticut, next.
I have three grown children dealing with the child care issue, and they don't make a lot of money. Two of them work for a little better than minimum wage, but yet they're dealing with the child care issue in a legal manner, and I don't know why there's even a consideration that this woman should be attorney general. She's broken the law. If you break the law, then you break the law. It's just not the thing to do, and you shouldn't be allowed to do it. Not Zoe Baird, not anyone.
Fort Lauderdale, you're on the air.
I believe that everybody has a fair chance and opinion, you know, as far as what she has done. I believe that there's two sides to every story, and I think that perhaps we should be able to listen to what she has to say. I don't think that what she did was right, and I don't think that anybody that represents the Attorney General for the United States should do anything illegal. And if she has been found to be, you know, in suspicion of it, I think that she, you know, should resign or withdraw from this. I don't think it's very fair.
Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Good morning.
Yes, I have several concerns about Ms. Baird, but one of the most pressing ones in Mr. Clinton's agenda was environment, insurance reform, cable regulation. I mean, he's gotten onto every issue that she's got a conflict in, and I can't believe this woman is actually being considered. I've heard Republicans and Democrats both during the hearings express that, all right, we'll forgive you for the child care issue, we'll forget it. That's wrong. I'm working, my wife's working, we're paying $15,000 a year in child care just to keep two children in child care while we work to pay our taxes. And yet, this woman's going to be representing the legal arm of the government. She should be above reproach. She should have no connections to big business or any kind of conflict with environmental, insurance, or regulatory issues. And she's got all three conflicts, plus a cloud in her background.
Summers Point, New Jersey.
These people who are calling up and criticizing Ms. Baird's, you know, and what have you, I can understand, you know, their feelings and what have you. But where are these people? Why, you know, where were these people when Ed Meese and was in the Justice Department, and, you know, as unqualified and all the other things that they covered up, and while they were shredding documents to make sure that nobody got to Reagan, where are these people at then? That's all I really wanted to say.
Denton, Texas. Go ahead, please.
As regards to Zoe Baird, I hate to say it, but I think that she should withdraw her name from consideration, in part because I think that being the highest official as far as law enforcement or prosecution in the land, she should be above reproach legally. Secondly, we have for years sit by and seen people pardoned and allowed to misuse their positions and get by with small and large infractions of justice, and I think a clear message from the Clinton administration right now would be we're not going to tolerate that.
C-SPAN's viewers comment on the nomination of Zoe Baird to be United States Attorney General. We'll hear some of the other questions asked by the committee in a few minutes.
This is C-SPAN's weekly radio journal. The program is a public service of the cable television industry, and we'd like to hear what you think. You can write to C-SPAN's weekly radio journal, 400 North Capitol Street Northwest, Suite 650, Washington, D.C., 20001. Or call us at area code 202-626-4862. You'll hear that information again later in the program, and you'll also hear what some of our listeners had to say. Members of the United States Senate put their work on hold only briefly Wednesday for the inaugural ceremony. Senate committees spent the rest of the week hearing from several of President Clinton's cabinet nominees. The most controversial of those nominations is that of Zoe Baird to be Attorney General. Ms. Baird and her husband admitted hiring two undocumented aliens to do domestic work and provide child care, but failed to pay some taxes for those workers. While that part of the nomination has received lots of media attention, it wasn't the only issue explored by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee Tuesday. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch is the ranking Republican on the committee.
The first freedom mentioned in the Constitution of the United States, in the Bill of Rights, if you will, is religious freedom. In 1990, in the Oregon versus Smith case, many of us believed that the Supreme Court seriously impaired that freedom. And as a result of that decision, a state or federal government need no longer have a compelling interest in order to justify a burden on the free exercise of religion. This test was very protective of religious exercise, that is, the compelling interest test, especially for religious minorities in any community. In Smith, a majority of the court basically said the government only needs a rational basis for burdening the exercise of religion with a law of general applicability. Now, I'd like to know what your view is of the rationale of the majority of opinion, and do you believe that the compelling interest test rather than the rational interest test is the proper one under the free exercise clause for religious freedom?
Senator, I think this is a very important issue, and one that I know that both you and Senator Kennedy and others on this committee feel very strongly about. The Oregon versus Smith decision has raised the concern of many different religions that their practices will somehow be examined by the state in a way that has not occurred before. The compelling interest test gave strength to people's feeling that the state would not lightly examine, not just interfere with, the practices of religious groups. And I, in my first substantive answer to a question, probably shouldn't be going out on a limb in an area where President-elect Clinton hasn't spoken, but...
But he has spoken. He said that he supports this.
He has said that he supports it and thinks that it's a very good idea, and I'll go out on a limb here a little bit further and say that I think it should be one of the highest priorities in the early days of the administration, because I think that there's an anxiety now that really just need not exist, that states will, as I say, examine as well as potentially regulate the practices of various religious groups, and particularly religious minority groups in different communities.
Well, thank you, because I really feel very deeply about that, as do most religions in this country, and since it is the first mention in the Bill of Rights, I don't want it given short shrift by the courts or by us in the Congress or anybody else for that matter. Now, let me just shift to maybe just a few questions about crime and about how you're going to approach the problems there. How is the Clinton administration, if you feel that you can disclose this at this time, going to address rural crime in America? Because there are a lot of our smaller states that are beset with rural crime and rural criminal problems, as well as the urban criminal problems that many of us face throughout the country.
As I said in my opening statement, violent crime in this country is a pervasive problem and one of the highest priorities of this administration. It is a quality of life issue, and as someone who grew up in a small town, I can appreciate that the transformation of the quality of life in rural communities has also been profound over these last couple of decades, particularly the last decade. Where I grew up in Bothell, where Senator Murray discussed this small town of a two-block-long Main Street, no one ever locked their doors. In fact, I don't even think we had sound locks on our doors. But I know that today that is not a comfortable situation for people all over the country because their crime is ever present. And it's something that we as a federal government have a tremendous responsibility to get at with the local community police forces. As Senator Biden mentioned, one of the first groups that I met with were representatives of law enforcement from all over the country, cities, small towns, state troopers, urban policemen, rank and file, management, a really broad range. And I am very honored to say, and I thank them for doing this even after this immigration issue became an issue, I'm very honored to say that the heads of all these major police organizations have endorsed my nomination to be Attorney General. And I trust they've done that because they appreciate that I am committed to high priority attention, creative programs, sound management to get at the issue of crime in communities of all sizes. It has been, I think, one of the most profound effects on the quality of life for the people in this country. And economic security only goes so far, but even if people have a good job, they can't be comfortable and satisfied as citizens of this country if they are afraid to walk in the streets at night or feel that their children can't play outside.
Senator Hatch and Attorney General nominee Zoe Baird. Late Thursday, Ms. Baird asked that her name be withdrawn after a second day of questions from the committee. President Clinton agreed to withdraw the nomination. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee heard from two nominees this Tuesday. Hazel O'Leary is President Clinton's choice for Energy Secretary. One of the senators questioning her was ranking Republican Malcolm Wallop of Wyoming.
On December 12th, you observed we're no better off in terms of stepping back from that foreign barrel of oil than we were almost in 1974, and that's unconscionable for the nation. In your answers to my question number one, for the record, you stated that national energy policy should be judged upon whether there are adequate, reliable, least-cost supplies of energy available to foster economic growth, and that the success of energy policy should also be judged based upon developing policies which begin to reduce the economic and national security risks of foreign supplies while minimizing the environmental impacts of resource production. I have several questions that follow from these statements. One, would you consider today's international oil market as a so-called free market?
No, I would not.
Would you agree that one of the reasons that the United States' reliance on imported oil is the consequence of policies that emphasize low-cost energy supplies at the expense of reliability and national security?
Yes, I would.
Would you agree that in order to increase the reliability of energy supplies and reduce those national security risks from imported oil, that the price American consumers pay for energy is likely to increase?
Yes, I would.
On the same day, on December 12th, you emphasized that we've got to utilize the wide range of demand side and supply side options to ensure adequate supplies of energy resources at reasonable and environmentally correct costs. In your answers to my question number three, for the record, you observed that, quote, the supply-side options available to the nation include natural gas, renewable resources, oil, coal, and nuclear fuel. You also observe that the market should dictate resource use to the extent practical. However, for several years, public policies have favored one resource over others. Given this, the nation must encourage natural gas use and technologies which encourage energy efficiency and the use of alternative energy resources, close quote. These statements appear contradictory. Would you comment about them?
Yes, I would. As I attempted to state in my opening remarks, Senator Wallop, I quite frankly do firmly believe that the budget with respect to hard path may be a little miskewed and has not served conservation and renewables the way it should have.
Wait, would you move the microphone a little closer?
Surely I would. You may recall that I, in the Carter administration, was the administrator for conservation and environment. And I believe that conservation and renewables have a contribution to make. And what has happened over the last 12, and what has happened over the last 12 years is the Bush and the Reagan administration has walked away from an earlier commitment to those resources as well. And I believe we've got to put some funding back. And that has been the commitment of President-elect Clinton. And I sit before you today because it's my commitment as well. I don't believe that we can, I've stated that, and anyone who's known me in my career also knows that I am pragmatic enough to understand that you don't withdraw from a system and from fuel and energy sources that are existing and technologically correct and feasible and don't do environmental harm. So we've got to do them both, and I recognize that that is the dilemma of the position I sit before you seeking today, to try to do them both.
Energy Secretary-designee Hazel O'Leary. Later that day, the committee heard from former Arizona Governor Bruce Babbitt, nominated to be the Secretary of the Interior. He also answered questions from Senator Wallop.
Going back to your statement and your years of advocacy, in your statement you praised, and Chairman and I basked in your praise about the energy strategy bill. But when you were your League of Conservation Voters gave two votes if people had voted not to invoke cloture on that thing. In fact, you said some less than charitable things about that. Now, are we to assume that the League of Conservation Voters and other environmental groups who are advocates basically do not say what's on their mind, but say what is necessary to be heard by the members of their groups?
Senator, as these, someone once said, Bruce, your greatest failing in public life is that you've never had an unwritten thought. And with the ability of Nexus and all of these tools, I now see myself confronted with an avalanche of statements. And it reminds me of what Mo Udall used to characterize as his prayer for politicians, which I think of much these days. He said, Lord, grant me the wisdom to utter gracious and generous remarks today, for tomorrow I may have to eat them. And in direct answer to your question, I believe in the broad goals as a private citizen and advocate of the League of Conservation Voters. I was not a participant in the scorecard process. That is a process undertaken by the legislative representatives of the various environmental groups that come together under that umbrella. And I would also say that during my time in public office, I detested scorecards. I threw most questionnaires in the wastebasket and tried my best to ignore the scorecards. And I suspect that my reward upon confirmation, if you choose to do so, will be to join all of you in being irritated by the score that I get in my new job.
It isn't quite as far as I went in the phrasing the question. I asked if we were to presume that the League of Conservation Voters and other advocacy groups are inclined to make statements that are based primarily for the consumption of their membership and not for an apt characterization of the topic under consideration. In fact, I mean, you had some rather, you personally, not the League, but as chairman of the League, had some rather uncomplimentary things to say about the chairman and I, and we didn't need Nexus or Lexus to discover it, and we found it rather early.
Senator, I suspect that that it is true that advocacy groups do from time to time stray across that line. I have tried very hard to keep it within bounds in my personal statements. When I stray across to the personal, my policy is to look the person in the eye and apologize.
Interior Secretary-designee Bruce Babbitt. The Senate wrapped up the previous week with a pair of hearings. Donna Shalala is President Clinton's choice to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. She was questioned by members of the Senate Finance Committee, including Iowa Republican Charles Grassley.
Your predecessor, now Secretary Sullivan, followed a policy of expedited waiver approval for welfare reform projects that would be suggested to him and approved by the various states. What's going to be your attitude towards that policy of innovative welfare reform demonstrations to be asking when states ask for those waivers?
Sympathetic, Senator. President-elect is a former governor. He believes very strongly that the creative juices of the intergovernmental system have very much come out of states over the last decade, and indeed there has been activity at the state level in relationship to both health as well as social welfare. Simultaneously, I think that when we call something an experiment, we ought to make sure that we know what we're experimenting, what kind of evaluation we're building in, what are the criteria. It seems to me that we want to learn some things out of these experiments, and we need clear guidelines for that, but we also need a fair and quick process. I think Secretary Sullivan has made some moves in that regard. I do want to review, though, issues that have to do with the nature of the evaluations and what we're trying to learn and what we're trying to experiment with.
Do you know whether or not you have some disagreements, as you know those now, with
no,
that process?
No, I do not know.
You do not know. Okay. Senator Baucus brought up the problems of health care in rural America. Thank you for discussing those with me when you were in my office. As a follow-up and in direct relationship to the issue of national health care plan, the points often made to me in Iowa, and I'm sure it's made in other rural states as well, that states need latitudes in any adopted health care plan that's national to fit circumstances that might be unique or different to states or at least to regions of countries. How much state discretion will there be under the President-elect's reform proposal? I know it's going to be 100 days before it's going to be presented, but this issue must be discussed at some level now of leeway for states to meet different circumstances.
We have to have enough so that the program works for our rural areas and for the differences between our rural areas and the differences between different parts of the country. Simultaneously, if it's going to be a national program, it has to have the same kind of fairness and basic benefits package. So we need to balance the flexibility against our desire to have a basic benefits package so that every American has access to that. When we come up with a plan, must be able, in my judgment, to answer the questions of those of you that represent states with rural areas that don't have as much access to health care, as well as understand that this federal system of ours requires that that we give states some flexibility so they can shape the program. For us, we'll shape it to be uniquely American. For the states, they must shape it to fit with their states.
HHS Secretary Designee Donna Shalala. At the same time, Mississippi Congressman Mike Espy, nominated as Secretary of Agriculture, was sitting in front of the Senate Agriculture Committee. Indiana Senator Richard Lugar is the committee's ranking Republican.
I raised specifically questions that were raised and apparently resolved with the FEC, in which your brother had a responsibility, apparently with regard to the bookkeeping, for your campaign. There were questions raised as to double entries or even the possibility of double payments by the FEC. How have those questions been resolved, and what comment can you make that may at least clear the record on that subject?
Senator Lugar, I appreciate the question. Of all the episodes in my political career thus far, the one that has caused me the most grief has been this entire episode with regard to the House bank, if you will. And I received the Wiley letter, which served to a great degree to exonerate, you know, all of us. But there were other questions that I had to appear at Justice to answer directly to the FBI agents and to the deputies who had been assigned to my case. There was an appearance of some things that that did not jibe with the facts, and I'll be specific. Looking through my records, my House administration disclosure form, my activity at the House bank, even my credit union accounts, which I turned over to them, and my FEC reports. The only one that caused them some concern was the FEC report, because they appear to be some false entries, or at least some clerical problems there, and some red flags that appeared that had to do with reimbursements made to me from my political campaign. They were always in round figures, you know, $1,500, $1,600, but not $1,635. And the red flag appeared, and I had to go and answer these questions. My brother, Tom Espy, was under contract to my campaign to help raise money for me. The reality, as I expressed to the Justice Department, was that for a period of time, you know, during the period where we could keep honoraria, during the early part of my career and others, I made several trips around the nation speaking. My first year in Congress, I made 380 speeches around the nation, first year. Some were political and others were not, but the ones that were political, I was due a reimbursement for hotel and air travel and those kinds of things. And usually, as was the case then, I gave the receipts to my brother, but I didn't need the money. I just let the receipts aggregate, if you will. And when I felt that my resources were not as great, I would ask for what was due me. And usually, that was the period that this check had been written to me for a round figure. I take some comfort in the fact and that never at any time during the entire period of this record keeping did I receive a check in any greater amount than was due me.
Agriculture Secretary nominee Mike Espy. Wednesday, just after President Clinton's inauguration, the full Senate voted to confirm Lloyd Bentsen as Secretary of the Treasury, Les Aspin as Secretary of Defense, and Warren Christopher as Secretary of State. Thursday, the rest of the cabinet nominees were confirmed by the full Senate, many by voice vote. President Clinton's cabinet is now complete, except for the position of Attorney General. Next, we'll bring you to Washington, D.C. for some of the sounds of the inaugural celebration. This is C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal. Thank you.
Look at this thing. See that fuzzy, furry thing? That's a microphone. So everything you say, that man right there, see the earphones he has?
Whether you want it or not.
That's right.
I bet a blasted his ears.
Yeah, you probably did learn.
How are you?
President Clinton, so nice to meet you. I have a 20-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old son at home, and you're the hope to them.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, good morning and good luck.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Joshua Poole.
Hi, Joshua.
Candy.
How you doing?
Hi,
Candy.
Hi.
Where are you from?
East Haven, Connecticut, actually.
Really?
East
Haven. I was there in the campaign. I loved it.
My dad said you live there, too.
President Clinton holding a reception for thousands of people the morning after his inauguration. Guests were chosen by a lottery held over the last couple of weeks. Wednesday, the attention of the world turned to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of the 42nd president. Most of the activity took place on Pennsylvania Avenue, from the swearing-in on the Capitol steps to the president's walk to his reviewing stand at the White House. To find out more about this historic street, C-SPAN's Susan Swain talked with M.J. Brody, the executive director of the Pennsylvania Avenue Development Corporation.
Is Pennsylvania Avenue just another street?
Oh, it's a very special street. If it could remember and it could talk, it could tell us about American history. That's not every street.
What is the Pennsylvania Avenue Development Corporation?
Well, we're a small federal agency. The seed was really President Kennedy. When he came down the avenue in January of 1961 on that snowy day, he didn't like what he saw. And he suggested by starting a temporary commission to improve the avenue and really give it the physical presence that symbolically it's always had in America.
From his idea to today, how many years did it take to envision what Pennsylvania would look like and carry it out?
Well, it's taken a long time, as these things do. Actually, the corporation that I represent didn't get born until 1972. Before that, there were a series of commissions and all, and we went through a series of plans and then began our work in revitalizing the avenue. We're about 80% done. It's come a very long way, and we'd like to think that President Kennedy would be proud of what's happened.
How much money has been spent on Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, it's your money. It's the taxpayers' money. We've spent about $149 million of public money, and with that, we have brought in $1.5 billion of private investment.
Pennsylvania Avenue, of course, is a very long street. What buildings are the boundaries of the portion of it that is the most historical or represented by the corporation?
When Congress created us, they gave us the authority and the responsibility to deal between the White House and the Capitol. And in that stretch, which is about 1.6 miles, both along the avenue and the blocks to the north, in some cases going as far as three or four blocks, for example, up to the Portrait Gallery, that's the territory in which we've been working.
And what exactly was the goal? What were you trying to achieve in that stretch?
Well, the goal, at least as I see it, was not to reproduce some of the great avenues of Europe that we're all familiar with in Paris and London, but to create a truly American place that represented our culture and our diversity and our architecture, and to do it with the very best of the late 20th century design and talent that we can bring to bear on it.
Along that stretch, which you call a very American stretch, is, as I recall, the Canadian Embassy.
That's right.
Why would we include a foreign embassy on this very American stretch?
Well, like most things, it's a simple story. The Canadian government approached us about building a new embassy exactly at the same time as our government approached Canada about building an American embassy on Parliament Avenue in Ottawa, Canada's main street. As life had it, we're still planning our embassy. The Canadians have finished theirs.
In addition to the Canadian embassy, tell me about some of the other buildings that are along that stretch of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, there's a great series of buildings, some very small but wonderful, like the little Sears building at 7th Street, in which Matthew Bradio had his studio, in which he took the picture of Lincoln that's on the $5 bill. And we succeeded in working with a developer to restore it. That's a small gem. The large building that everybody remembers probably best is the Willard Hotel, because so much great history occurred there. But it was also vacant and falling down for 15 years. We managed to help rescue it, bring it back, and we're all proud of what it looks like today.
Are there also open spaces?
Oh, there are quite a few. As a matter of fact, the first part of our strategy was to change the public environment and to create a whole series of open spaces, such as Pershing Park, Freedom Plaza, Market Square, where the Navy Memorial is, and also line the avenue with 700 willow oak trees. So the open space is really the unifying factor in the whole design of the avenue.
M.J. Brody of the Pennsylvania Avenue Development Corporation. President Clinton's inaugural speech was the subject of much speculation, and Mr. Clinton reportedly finished it only hours before it was to be delivered. After being sworn in by U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the new president stood on the Capitol steps in the January sunshine and addressed the huge crowd.
Our democracy must be not only the envy of the world, but the engine of our own renewal. There is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America. And so today we pledge an end to the era of deadlock and drift, and a new season of American renewal has begun. To renew America, we must be bold. We must do what no generation has had to do before. We must invest more in our own people, in their jobs, and in their future, and at the same time, cut our massive debt. And we must do so in a world in which we must compete for every opportunity. It will not be easy. It will require sacrifice. But it can be done, and done fairly, not choosing sacrifice for its own sake, but for our own sake. We must provide for our nation the way a family provides for its children. Our founders saw themselves in the light of posterity. We can do no less. Anyone who has ever watched a child's eyes wander into sleep knows what posterity is. Posterity is the world to come, the world for whom we hold our ideals, from whom we have borrowed our planet, and to whom we bear sacred responsibility. We must do what America does best, offer more opportunity to all, and demand more responsibility from all. It is time to break the bad habit of expecting something for nothing from our government or from each other. Let us all take more responsibilities, not only for ourselves and our families, but for our communities and our country. To renew America, we must revitalize our democracy. This beautiful capital, like every capital since the dawn of civilization, is often a place of intrigue and calculation. Powerful people maneuver for position and worry endlessly about who is in and who is out, who is up and who is down, forgetting those people whose toil and sweat sends us here and pays our way. Americans deserve better. And in this city today, there are people who want to do better. And so I say to all of you here, let us resolve to reform our politics so that power and privilege no longer shout down the voice of the people. Let us put aside personal advantage so that we can feel the pain and see the promise of America. Let us resolve to make our government a place for what Franklin Roosevelt called bold, persistent experimentation, a government for our tomorrows, not our yesterdays. Let us give this capital back to the people to whom it belongs.
President Clinton. His day began at a Washington church and continued into Thursday morning with 11 inaugural balls. Here then are just a few of the sounds of Wednesday's inaugural celebration.
Guide them to perceive what is right, and grant them both the courage to pursue it and the grace to accomplish it, and ever remind us all of the requirements you set before us.
I am that tree planted by the river which will not be moved. I, the rock, I, the river, I, the tree, I am yours. your passages have been paid. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived. But if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palms of your hands. Mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self.
Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder that the crowd estimate for today's inaugural parade are expected to reach as many as 1 million people. So you have lots of company. With most of that 1 million... Dubbed the Pride of the Southland, has dazzled audiences with their high-stepping and innovative circle drills. It's the University of Tennessee Marching Band.
Washington celebrates the inauguration of the 42nd president. Former President Bush, meanwhile, rode from the east front of the Capitol in a helicopter to Andrews Air Force Base, where he boarded the airplane he could no longer call Air Force One, for the flight back to Houston. We'll hear from the former president in just a few minutes. You're listening to C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal.
Since 1979, cable television viewers have watched gavel-to-gavel coverage of the House of Representatives on C-SPAN. In 1986, when the U.S. Senate went live on TV, C-SPAN 2 was there. Now the Clinton administration and the 103rd Congress are set to get to work, and you'll see it all on C-SPAN. C-SPAN is where the television call-in program began, and you can still talk back to Washington twice each day. The public affairs programming on C-SPAN, C-SPAN 2, and C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal are provided as a public service by your local cable television company. Thursday, the Democratic and Republican leaders of the United States Senate were each allowed an hour of what's called leader time to talk about their goals for the 103rd Congress. Friday morning, Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole of Kansas appeared on a C-SPAN call-in program to discuss the Republican agenda.
A bunch of these revolving door stories are around. I'm looking at a Richmond Times-Dispatch headline, Clinton's order may become law, lobbying curbs included in bill. This is the proposal by Senator David Boren that would adopt the same rules for the Senate and the House as they have downtown for the five-year lobbying revolving door law. Do you think that'll pass? Think it should?
I think 5 years may be a bit too long, but I think we're going to have to do something, and it may pass. Senator Boren, Senator Domenici chair this new task force. That's one thing we get blamed for. Instead of trying to do it, we just create another committee, and they spend another 6 months. But I would guess there are going to be more stringent rules on sort of the revolving door. You leave the government, you're back in practice. You're back dealing with the same people you left the day before. There's something about that that's not right. So you have to have some restraint. 5 years, that may be a bit too long.
What kind of marks would you give President Clinton this first week?
Well, his first 48 hours, I think he's probably doing all right. He had a good short speech, nothing really memorable. You're not going to remember any of the lines in it, but I think he laid out his philosophy and what he wants to do. It kept everybody's attention. And he's had a bad day yesterday or this morning with the withdrawal of Zoe Barrett as Attorney General nominee, but otherwise he's done quite well. And now the hard part comes. The hard part is governing. And one thing he did do late yesterday that I think was a mistake, he's not going to leave these so-called deficit caps in place, and what he's going to do is increase the deficit rather than hold the deficit down. So his first act official act would be to increase the deficit and not keep it under strict restraint in the so-called Graham-Rudman provision.
When do you think you'll have the first important substantive issue on the Senate floor where you are having to deal with it from, say, a minority standpoint where there's opposition?
I think part of the first thing will be the family leave bill, which is passed to Congress, vetoed by the president. We'll offer an alternative program, which we think is better, covers more employees. But it'll pass, and it'll be signed by the president. But there'll be a lot of debate. That may come as early as next couple of weeks. I think there will be an effort on the part of the Clinton administration to do, say, campaign finance reform, the family leave bill, what we call the motor voter registration bill, making it easier for some people to register. Things that have passed before and been vetoed, they may rush through the Congress. But I would hope that on big, big issues like health care, that we take our time. Because if we don't have bipartisan consensus on health care, there won't be any bill for a while, because they don't have the votes, we don't have the votes, and it's one of these issues I think we have to work together on.
You like to be called the Senate...
I like to be called the Republican leader.
Why that versus the minority leader?
Well, I'm not certain whether people understand minority and majority. I think most people do. I am the minority leader. We are in the minority. People do understand. I remember when Senator Byrd went from majority to minority leader, he put across his door, Democratic leader. And I thought it was a pretty good idea. So when I went from the majority to the minority, I put Republican leader.
Front page of the Wall Street Journal, the headline is, tax increases seem inevitable, including some on the middle class. Would you agree?
If they're going to make, if President Clinton is going to carry out his promise to cut the deficit in half in 4 years, which he's sort of backing away from, he has to do it either by spending or taxing or a combination thereof. And I assume he's looking for some combination. But the choices aren't good. You have to raise gas taxes. You raise corporate taxes. You can have a broad-based energy tax. But there again, you've got splits within the Democratic Party. And as I've said before, President Clinton may be looking to us for help from time to time when he can't get it from Democrats. And if it's a good idea, he'll have Republican support.
A lot of the senators who were calling yesterday for Zoe Baird to step down were Southern Democrats. Are those potential allies for the Republican side?
Not necessarily. I don't know what there were. There were, I think, three or four, the early ones. My colleague, Senator Kassbaum, also was calling with regret, I might add, for her to withdraw. But it was building. I don't see any pattern, but I think certainly Senator Breaux, Senator Johnson, Senator Shelby were three Southern Democrats who were right out front saying, you know, you just can't have someone who's violated the law, maybe unintentionally, whatever, violated the law, be the Attorney General of the United States. And they were right.
Senator Dole. Monday, a forum in Washington looked back at the 1992 campaign and ahead to what challenges are faced by the new administration. One of the speakers was David Beckwith, press secretary for former Vice President Dan Quayle. Mr. Beckwith answered questions from the audience.
What were some of the things you could have done to combat some of the negative image problems that he had, that the media was putting out on him? Because I did a paper on him, so I know some of the positive things that he did do in the past prior to becoming vice president.
Well, of course, we did our best to talk to the press and to make known to the press what Quayle had done. But as was indicated by this earlier question, the press, good news about somebody is not necessarily news for the press. And I agree with the earlier questioner along those lines. I don't think it's necessarily right. There were two different approaches that we could take. One would be this, that if he quietly set about doing his job, that eventually didn't make any huge mistakes, then gradually the image would change. The other approach would have been that we did something like going on one of the late night television shows that Johnny Carson or Jay Leno or something like that, and have him show in a sort of an unscripted give or take that he had a great sense of humor, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we felt that the former course was the better. We never did any of this splash type of thing. We felt that over the long run, it would be better if Quayle just went about and did his job well. And what we didn't recognize was this, that, you know, for the 3 years prior to the potato incident, and I'm bringing it up myself this year, which happened, I think, in May, he had not made a serious mistake of any type. And yet the press was so, and I guess the public, were so intent on confirming this stereotype that they had created in 88 and early 89, that when that potato incident came, it was one of the great stories of our time. Now, you know, now, do you remember the story about Bush and the Safeway or the supermarket scanner? Well, that was a similar deal with the potato incident. You go into a photo op, and you're going through the motions. You're supposed to be animated. You put your mind on in kind of a second gear, and you just go through the motions. In his case, he was handed a set by the teacher of spelling cards that had the word potato misspelled, and he was basically just, you know, going through the motions for the cameras, just as Bush was going through the motions trying to appear interested and animated. And in the Safeway scanner, he'd seen those scanners, but the press used that Safeway incident as indication that Bush had no idea what real people did, how they checked their groceries out, and it was a symbol. With the potato incident, people leapt on this as an indication that Dan Quayle didn't have what it takes. And that one incident, of course, was really blown up out of proportion. So I think in the end, everyone who knows what they're talking about in Washington knew that Quayle had a good year this year. And the general public, I don't think, yet knows it. But I think among people that are opinion leaders, Dan Quayle is back on his feet. And if he wants to run in 96, and I don't think he will, but he probably will in the future, beyond 96, then I think he'll be in pretty good shape.
Former Vice Presidential Press Secretary David Beckwith. Late Wednesday afternoon, former President Bush greeted supporters in Houston as he arrived from Washington, D.C.
Well, this is the first minute of the beginning of our new life, and I can't think of any place better to start than right here where we began our political life, Houston, Texas. And I think it was a lovely inauguration. I had a chance to wish our new president well. And now it's back to the real world for the Bushes. Privileged to have served and to have had this wonderful opportunity to be in the White House, and indeed for 12 years in and out of the White House, and in serving as vice president, as president. But there's a time to stay and time to go, time to fold them. And we only wish our new president all the best. And let me say to our fellow Houstonians that our objective now is to be good private citizens and neighbors. We're not going to cause you any problems. We're going to try to do something helpful to the community. And we're going to enjoy life with our kids that live here and our grandkids, some of whom aren't here, some of whom will be coming, and others that live here in Houston. And all I can say, it's been one hell of a ride, and we are very, very lucky people. Barbara and George Bush, your neighbors, thank you.
Former President Bush. Next, some of your comments on C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal.
Each week we invite you to call us with your comments about the Weekly Radio Journal. Here are a couple of thoughts we heard after last week's program.
I've been a Republican ever since I've been a voter, but I'm a Goldwater Republican. And the Republican Party has missed out, and that's why Power America and United We Stand are going to become more powerful in the years to come. There's been a separation of church and state since the founding of our country, and it needs to stay that way. And people like Pat Robertson and Mr. Buchanan need to leave the Republican Party alone, or the Republican Party is just going to have to deal with new people to run against.
The point that I'm bringing up is that I noticed many of the people who call into C-SPAN sound as if they have they're sort of older and they have the time, and they sound like sort of middle and upper middle. You know, they have the money to afford cable at least, and that's a certain economic segment. How wonderful it would be if C-SPAN could acquire a national, or could be offered a national satellite network of UHF channels. In other words, there are so many dozens of unused UHF channels on the TV band that are wasted, and that would be well served by just by being given a direct feed of the C-SPAN programming, so that people throughout the country, most of which still can't afford cable, especially with the cable rates going so high, could have access to C-SPAN. I would love to see many of the people who are unemployed, who are part of minority groups, have access to the kind of information and the inside way machinations of government and the processes involved. I think that could be extremely, perhaps even transformative, if that's not too large a word to use.
If you have comments about the Weekly Radio Journal, let us hear them. We'll give you the address and the phone number next. C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal is a public service of the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network, produced by Tom Patton and Beth Talisman, with production assistance by Michael Hiblin and engineered by Chris Montgomery. If you have comments about the program, write to C-SPAN's Weekly Radio Journal, 400 North Capitol Street, Northwest, Suite 650, Washington, D.C., 20001, or call us at area code 202-626-4862. Again, that's 400 North Capitol Street, Northwest, Suite 650, Washington, D.C., 20001, or call 202-626-4862. 4862.